the idea of belonging is about community. It's about being centered in whatever's happening within the space in which you live, learn, love, play, and laugh.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Illuminated Podcast. My name is Kieran Koditala. I have with me Dr. Michael Torrance. Michael Torrance is the seventh seated president of Motlow State Community College. Since being named president in 2018, Motlow State has scaled its presence into international arenas, connecting its rich history and location that directly ties the institution to world-famous Jack Daniel Distillery, George Tickle Tennessee Whiskey, and more recently, Nearest Green Distillery, leading the development and coming edition of distilling program in college's academic inventory. Under Dr. Torrance's leadership, Motlow State has transformed itself into a cutting-edge, award-winning institution on multiple fronts. Dr. Torrance is a passionate career educator. He has worked in higher education for more than 25 years as a faculty, mid-level senior administrator, and ultimately CEO. His diverse areas of expertise include research, adult education, student success, academic affairs, staff development, distance learning, and many, many things that we're going to talk about on the podcast. Dr. Torrance, welcome to Illuminated Podcast.
Kieran, thank you for having me today, and I'm looking forward to our discussion.
So you are a wealth of knowledge, and I don't even know where to begin talking about the future of higher education or your role in higher education. But there's a couple of things that, you know, caught my attention about Motlow State Community College. One is your distillery program. It sounds like a very uniquely Tennessee bourbonish, if you will. And I want to hear...
Tennessee whiskey,
if you will. I want to hear more about what goes on in a distillery program and how unique this program is.
Well, thank you for starting off with the softball. The Tennessee distilling program is focused on Tennessee whiskey. And obviously, Tennessee whiskey can only be made as a spirit in Tennessee. The claim to fame is our location to Jack Daniel. We are a part of the quote-unquote whiskey trail. The Motlow family, who are descendants of Jack Daniel, actually gave the college over 180 acres in the 60s to begin Motlow State Community College. The idea behind creating the distilling program was birthed by Ms. Fawn Weaver, who is the CEO of Uncle Nearest Distilling over in Bedford County. And the idea came over, like all good ideas, over lunch. We talked about what it would mean for our economy and our student population, both those coming through the normal pipeline and graduating from high school, and then those who were mid-career that looked at becoming a part of the lore of the Tennessee whiskey trail. So in a distilling program, you have lots of math and science and chemistry, because there's a science making it look and taste the way that it does. And if you are someone who imbibes and tastes spirits, look at the color. And when you talk about taste, it's no different than being a sommelier with wine and how someone could taste a vanilla or a certain kind of cinnamon, or as Jack Daniel and others now have created, apple, the cinnamon that is more like a fireball kind of, but sure. It's Jack Fire, as well as Jack Apple, the lemonade, the Jack and Cola. As well as the different brands associated with our other Whiskey Trail partners. Mm-hmm. So also, we had to look at this from multiple tiers, because it wasn't just about creating the science of the spirit. Dovetailing off of the distilling program will be culinary, hospitality, and tourism and management, which are all a part of the industry in the spirits sector. You have to have someone who can manage and make sure things move and production is met and quotas and numbers are met. On a day-to-day basis, how long does something need to stay in a barrel? And the higher inside of a barrel house, the hotter it is, which gives the aging process a different maturation than at the lower parts of the barrel house. And then when we talk about the entrepreneurship or craft distilling part of it, marketing, you know, social marketing and media have become a big player in how you represent your quote-unquote brand. And then lastly, culinary. And this is probably my favorite part of it because you get to eat. The idea of creating foodstuffs that have tinges and spritzes of these different spirits in them to have a very particular type of culinary appeal for those who would come to this part of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I was schooled just a couple of months ago because I was always, I'm a big Scotch whiskey fan. So I have my set of, you know, single malt Scotch whiskeys I always like talk highly about. And so there was one fellow business partner of mine from a payments company, and he's a big bourbon fan. And you know, like, well, you know, I don't think bourbon can ever compare to Scotch or whatever. And he was like, well, why don't I give you the taste of what a good bourbon should taste like? And he gave me this, like, just a 10-minute overview on like small batch and different flavors and Kentucky versus, you know, Jack Daniels versus like how you make it. There's so much skill involved in making a good bourbon, because it's not just about, you know, with single, again, I'm not saying that, you know, Scotch whiskey is easy, but it's more about, for them, the variables are very simple. The type of cask that you put it in, and obviously the grains or grapes that go into it, and also the age. Those are three variables. With bourbon, there's a lot more to it. There's a lot more science involved. There's a lot more botany involved. There's not more chemistry involved. So I'm excited to see the distillery program. Do you agree with that? Again, I'm not really very smart at this, so I only know it from drinking stuff.
Hey, one, that's the best way to learn about it. Two, having conversations about it while you're doing it is the second best way to learn about it. And then the other part is to fill the gaps in through reading about it. So over the last 3 years or so, I've probably read a good 15 to 20 books that have to do with, not about the history of distilling, that has been part of my reading, but literally the science behind how do you make a spirit. So it's been pretty phenomenal. And you're absolutely right about the casks, and specifically in Tennessee, the charcoal and melon distilling process is unique to us, and is what makes our whiskey what it is. And then obviously, because we have what was once called the Lynchburg distilling method, the Lincoln County distilling method, not Lynchburg distilling method, but the Lincoln County distilling method, it is actually unique that we have water and limestone. So all of the right things have to come together. And when you start talking about the types of botanicals that you could potentially put inside of a spirit process to make it have a different type of savoir-faire or flavor, it starts to get really interesting. But I just like it neat and plain, instead of getting into all the other things. I'm interested as a learner and explorer in the space now to taste different things, but for the purposes of, this is what this tastes like, this is what this smells like.
I mean, I think that's what interests me the most about you, and I think I call myself a lifelong learner as well, because I think it goes without saying, like, I'll kind of bore you with this personal detail. You know, my son is just joined college, and my Georgia Tech, and then my daughter is in living with her mom, who lives in Illinois with her husband. My ex-wife with her husband. So a lot of people come and ask me, like, hey, what are you doing with the rest of your time? Because now that your son has moved out of the house and he's having a life of his own. And it's like, I really don't have as much time as you think I do, because I'm trying to learn to swim because I've never learned to swim before. I'm trying to learn to golf because I've, I recently took it up a year ago. And it drives me, it's not only keeps me busy, but it just makes me excited. So the point I'm trying to make is, I kind of explained my love of learning, because every time I learn a new thing, I feel like a child again, because that's that's when we learned the most. And I saw on your bio that, you know, to model lifelong learning, you recently earned a welding certificate through Motlos Automation and Robotics Training Center. Can you talk to me a little bit about your lifelong journey and learning journey, and also like why welding and what is special about Motlos Automation and Robotics Training Center?
Sure. I'll start with, you know, Motlos. We are very unique, as all institutions are. You know, we have our own culture. We have six different locations across 11 counties in southern Middle Tennessee, encompassing 4,500 square miles. We serve between 500 and one small location to upwards of over 3,000, almost 4,000 students in another location. So in total, over the course of the year, we're literally serving roughly 18 to 25,000 people annually. And so when you do the math, it's like, okay, I've been here 4 years, that's 100,000 people that we're impacting. That's magical for me. Mm-hmm. The idea that we are connected to Nissan, Bridgestone, Kasai North America, financial districts and corporations, Google, Microsoft, Apple, and then within our own region, we are also connected to Volkswagen and the Blue Oval City project that's happening in West Tennessee. So mm-hmm. we're unique in that we have a large contingent of engineers who work in our mechatronics and robotics programs. Yesterday we were having a conversation about how many years of experience these folks have. And just between three of them, there's 120 years of experience. And I said, well, let's add two more years, because now since I'm certified, doesn't my 2 years count? It was a big laugh, because absolutely it probably doesn't. I consider myself a tinkerer amongst these solid professionals in engineering. But because the robotics Automation Robotics Training Center and mechatronics programs have, I guess we could say that they have spurred some large interest for us nationally. We're one of the top 10 training centers in the nation. With the Automatics Robotics Training Center, people come in from all over the country. They're trained with Larry Flatt and Charlie King and Emmett. We have great facilities where we have the world's three largest robotics manufacturers all under one roof. So that's another unique quality. And the reason that I got into this idea of, hey, I need to learn another skill and something with my hands. My grandfather used to talk to me all the time about the importance of working with your mind and also mm-hmm. working with your hands. And my daughter recently finished a chemical engineering degree from Tennessee Technological University here in the Upper Cumberland. And as she was getting to the tail end of it, I was like, well, what are you learning that's applied? But I really believe it's important. There needs to be balance, and they don't need to be disparate. They need to be synonymous. If you're going to learn to engineer, you should also learn to solder. You should also learn to weld. You should also understand the concepts of material robotic material and handling. So we decided to take a course, and we went through 4 days of training. This program allows anyone, if you've never seen a robot before in a day in your life, in 5 days to 8 days with us, you become certified and can go someplace the next week and go to work. So that's the beauty of it, that one, you know, why the robotic material and handling certification, why the welding certification? One, it was something to do with my daughter. She was finishing up school. And then two, we could do it in 2 to 5 days. What better way to go about getting something done?
I agree. I think there's a lot to be said about like doing something physical. And I also struggle with that, being a technologist and always work in the fringes. Whenever I have to assemble, even I'm not talking about carpentry, I'm talking about like basically setting together a bookshelf. I always felt like, I felt like I was out of my domain. It's not because the bookshelf, setting up the bookshelf was hard. It was just like, I'm not good at it. I don't know how to do it. And I think a lot of this can be solved with just a training, if you will, or just some area where people can give you the support you need to build confidence. And I think that brings me to the other parts of your expertise that are extremely interesting for me. I think we'll talk about A couple of things. One is obviously the fact that your leadership in diversity, equity, and obviously inclusion, but you also included in your bio about belonging, which is very important. Like, yes, yeah. Diversity, equity, inclusion are important in that it's the organization doing it, saying we want to be more diverse, we want to be more equitable, we want to be more inclusive, but belonging is you doing it, saying, yes, I belong here. I belong in Harvard. I belong in Motlow State. I belong in America. I belong in my community. Wherever that is not coming from external things. It's coming from you.
Yes.
I thought it was kind of intriguing that you included that in your bio. Can you talk to me a little bit about your DEI initiatives as a president of Motlow State and also what, you know, is belonging a new thing that you added or is something that I have not been used to? Just give me some updates here.
Sure. Yeah, well, you know, the idea of belonging is about community. It's about being centered in whatever's happening within the space in which you live, learn, love, play, and laugh. And from my perspective, I've had a very unique and I guess interesting to some people and maybe not interesting to others, background of all of the eclectic things I've gone through in my life to get to the position that I am empowered and honored to lead an institution in the state of Tennessee. They allowed me to be president of an institution, one of the fastest growing counties in the state and in the nation. So what to do with that? The easy part is, yes, we're going to have classes every day. We're going to have a good CFI, financial index to make sure that we can take care of our employees. We're going to have a good R&R account, refurbish and refresh so that we can fix old pipes and put new roofs on. We're going to raise more money. We're going to have a good portfolio investment strategy. So those are the easy things from my vantage point. The difficult part is making sure that across the organization, not up or down, that everybody understands that they have space and agency and voice within the institution. And I constantly talk about the importance of leading from where you are, that you don't have to be, quote unquote, the president to lead, that the facilities and maintenance folks, they lead. Our frontline right. staff, they lead. Our mid-level administrators and staff, they lead. Community members that are assisting us and supporting our students, whether it be by helping them find a summer job, an intermittent job between semesters so that they can pay for books or gas and keep the lights on in between, they lead. And so this concept of belonging, it did spur out of my early work that was really concentrated on diversity, equity, and inclusion, but it is going beyond that concept of what I believe has become polarized and in some instances politicized with DE&I. So I wanted to move away from anything that was going to demystify what was important. And the important part is, if you come through our threshold or cross our threshold, you belong here with us. And we're going to do everything, no matter what you look like, tall, short, black, brown, rich, poor, trying to figure it out, have no idea, have a very clear idea. This is a space where you can find your next level of trajectory. And we want to do our damnedest to help you get there.
Yeah, I think that's important for sure. And I know a lot of DEI initiatives seek to do that, but they do it in terms of numbers. They're like, oh, let's make sure that we have one, X percent of African Americans, X percent of transgenders, X percent of, LGBTQAIX community or Latinx community. And it becomes a numbers game. But if you A, make it explicit that it is, you belong here, and not by saying it, but also making it a environment that is welcoming and supportive from, just like you're saying, from president all the way to the janitor's level, I think institution will truly feel as a community. I cannot applaud you enough for your leadership there.
Thank you. And it's I want to just make sure, it's not just me. We have a team of people who don't buy into the concepts of what our culture should look like, what we're building towards. We believe in it. And those who don't believe in it that need to sit back and say, hey, is this Michael Torrence guy for real? Are we really going in this direction? Or is this just another concept that a leader in higher education will throw out and we will not follow through with it? No, we believe in it, and we're making sure that we honor our past, because you know we're in the Southeast, and there are lots of things that are tied to the lore and the history of the Southeast. But we'll honor our past. We're working towards supporting the future, and where we can, and when we have the bandwidth to, we're looking forward, and we're looking future forward.
I mean, that's amazing. So I think there's also a couple other things about belonging that I want to bring back full circle about your experience with the welding, and also my failed experiences trying to assemble bookshelves. So is that like, you know, I've seen Evan, you know, just like you, I've been an entrepreneur, and a lot of my entrepreneurship journey was completely self-made. And I'm not saying it in a self-aggrandizing way either. I kind of like stumbled into it as part of my own professional career, where originally I was implementing a lot of student information systems, and I was asked to support more than the one customer I could support at a time. So I built out some professional services around that. And as we built it, we organically moved into a product-based company. But when you're dealing with, you know, this, with the current student population, when it comes to management, teaching them how to become an entrepreneur, there's a lot of theoretical ways of doing it by asking them to go through like ethics class or accounting and finance, which are all important. But I've kind of used this model with my son, where when he wanted to start competing in a challenge, we basically went through a go-to-market strategy saying, how do you design a product? How do you make sure that this product is available to the masses? How do you make it profitable? Right. And I think a big part of that, you know, bringing back to lifelong learning and belonging, is to give them the coaching and support they need to say, yes, I can do this. And B, when I fail, it's okay. I have somebody to help me get there. So I'm interested about your leadership and entrepreneurial business development, and how you know your college shows helps students get there, because I feel like that handholding or supporting model is very important for students in their you know, in their journey.
Yeah, so we have we started the first degree pathway in entrepreneurship in our system in the state of Tennessee, where a student could focus on entrepreneurship. And I think that's a very important concept. You know, you think of a trajectory that usually takes you 14 to 15 weeks to get through semester to semester to semester. We wanted to bake in micro credentials that allow someone to understand the bits and pieces that allow them to move into business for themselves. An idea is not enough. It is also the design and the idea and the execution and the idea. And then more importantly, who is going to be your market? So helping people understand that through an applied way, meaning I guess we have done a couple of things that are very akin to Shark Tank. This is where the idea came from to do it. I'm an English teacher by trade, and reading teacher by trade. And so I had my children come to one of my classes once, and at the end of it, and it's all tied to this concept of entrepreneurship and why we're doing it. At the end of the class, we're driving home, and I said, so what'd you think about my class? And I'm all excited because my children have come to my class and like, hey, this is what dad does. And they said, well, you sure talk a lot.
It's boring. That's what my kids say.
Yeah. Like, you sure talk a lot. And I was like, well, I was trying to share information. I was like, well, why don't you get more information from the class? And then it's like, eureka, it dawned.
That's amazing.
Right? So I shifted almost immediately to introducing VR. You know, we're talking 2013, 2014, introducing virtual reality, and then ultimately XR, you know, extended reality. But also asking our chambers of commerce, our business and industry leaders, hey, would you guys, like 3-5 of, you know, men and women who are business owners, come to the beginning of my class and the end of it Mm-hmm. I'm going to pitch an idea that's going to solve a social problem. And my students will write and research it the entire semester. Mm-hmm. And we'll tie it into the narrative essay, the comparison contrast essay. But each time they came into class, they had VR headsets to look into and learn more about that technology and apply what they were viscerally experiencing mm-hmm. through looking at the headsets, do a response writing on it. And then we tie that to the competencies, goals, and outcomes of the course. And by the end, they had built a product or a concept that they will pitch and to see if they would be funded. So mm-hmm. the cool thing, out of those two iterations of the course that I was able to finish, two multi-million dollar businesses came out of it. One was called Food for Your Mood that was mm-hmm. purchased by Grubhub. And then the other one is called We Deliver, which is another mm-hmm. food delivery business that's still owned by that same person who came to the class. And there are other offshoots to impact sustainability in our city with when do lights come on, when do they turn off? And instead of they're always blaring, like they should just not glare when no one's around, they should pop on when someone gets in the vicinity and then the street lights up. So there were some great ideas that came out of that. That's entrepreneurism 101. Idea, the design, and discovery, as well as the execution, and then who's your market? And we look at that in the same way with the development of our program, so that any of our programs can tie into our entrepreneurship degree. So across our whole catalog of programs, a student can tie in that entrepreneurship pathway and tie in their dreams and their aspirations into becoming an entrepreneur themselves.
No, I mean, I cannot stop blushing when you're talking about it, because I think a lot of what you're doing, we're trying to do it from the other side. We started based on my own personal experience helping Varun to bring that discussion full circle. Varun joined George Tech, and I was telling you, hey, Varun, why don't you, their advisor was saying, go join this accounting class or financial model class. And he calls me and says, Dad, I already know this stuff. Like, you already taught me, so I don't need to know these things. But I kind of got excited by what he has learned just by doing things, just like you're describing. So we started a offshoot of End-to-End called Socrates Labs in India with an explicit idea, just like you're doing, saying we're going to invite startups or students to come and pitch us idea. And if we like their idea and if we feel like it checks off a couple of boxes, obviously it has to be financially sustainable, that the business should be scalable and eventually be able to make money, but also it should be able to be sustainable for the environment, and not in terms of climate change, but sustainable as in it does some social good to the world we live in. So if it checks off those two boxes, then we incubate that business. So what we do is we give them free AWS hosting. We give them free integration platform yeah. to allow them to build databases and integrate databases, and also give them a managerial coaching to help them envision their product from whatever it currently is to a potentially $1 billion business. So, the Socrates Labs is kind of the same model that you're thinking. And I think we should definitely partner up together to leverage this idea of a socially good, VC firm or micro incubator, if you will. It does look like we're on a similar path here.
Yeah, I love that idea of any type of B Corp, where it is about the public good, public benefit. What's been awesome to see and encounter through our system offices and workforce development with the Tennessee Board of Regents and then the state of Tennessee's Tennessee Economic and Community Development offices, with people who are no longer working there because they've done such a great job. They've taken jobs in other places. Ann Thompson, Victoria Hirschberg, Jamari Brown, Corey Johns. These have been kind of like the team of people that have helped spur what Launch Tennessee is in terms of creating incubation space for Tennesseans, for our students here at Motlow, for people who live in Southern Middle Tennessee and across the state, to understand that the mantra in Tennessee is that we make things here, Tennessee made. And mm-hmm. when you think about it, like we whittle, we make things out of wood. We do metallurgy, we make things out of metal. we obviously we build homes and skyscrapers and just all kinds of magical things. We haven't figured out how to make the flying car yet. That's the thing we're waiting on.
You know, honestly, just give enough Kentucky whiskey to the scientists.
Yeah, they'll figure it out, right? But this is a state of innovation. It's constant, and that's why I keep using the word magical. When you have a modicum of success and people direct it at you as an individual, the individual ought to recognize that it is not you. It is the team of people that you're doing this with. So It's a ripple. And you're simply, perhaps from time to time, being the rock that goes into the pond that gives the idea reverberation and ripples through that water. And, you know, I recognized this early in life that to be successful, it takes teams of people. So we've got, you know, great faculty members that are doing killer things
or at least one good coach. Like sometimes just one good mentor as well, but you're absolutely correct. You need a team of people to support you as you continue to evolve or fail in the process.
Yeah, because failure is a part of success. And that's a very important thing to come to grips with, that it's okay to fail, because failure means you're that much closer, because you have to keep rowing. You can't give up. When the things get choppy and it doesn't make sense and you see an end in sight that doesn't look very good, you have to understand that it is an illusion. It is there to stop you. And as all barriers are there to stop you, you need to push through them. And so that's the mindset here, that we just simply will keep rowing. We'll push through barriers, all for the purposes of powering student success. We're going to get it done.
Yeah. I mean, I can go on and on about barriers because I think I was saying about my lifelong learning, I've been trying to learn swim for the last 6 months, and my kids are tired of me saying it, because every time I jump in the pool, I'm like, I text them saying, I think I broke I made a new breakthrough today. And it was like, well, my first breakthrough was being able to breathe underwater, and now I'm able to swim, like, I don't know, 15 feet into water. But trivial breakthroughs, but having that small sense of accomplishment and not giving up is something that it takes time. And like you're like you said, it's about giving that sense of belonging, giving that community is definitely important for students as they continue to find their way. Because I think you talked a little bit more about some of the new things that you're focused on as part of your robotics and automation training center. But in that process, I think you talked about metaverse and how you're trying to teach learning as part of that. And I also saw in your bio that you're looking at gamification as a platform for education and learning. This is something I've been talking about on this podcast since the early days of it a couple of years ago. I think there's a huge opportunity in gamification for people to learn without needing books, if you will. Can you talk to us a little bit about what you're doing to move education to leverage the power of technology, if you will?
Sure. So I was introduced to an education technology course at Tennessee Technological University, Dr. Carl Owens, and then introduced later subsequently to Dr. Robbie Melton. And both are ADEs, or Apple Distinguished Educators. From them, another light went on, the idea of open educational resources, the application of skilled-based learning or competency-based education, as well as what can you do with game theory and gamifying instructional and training? Because I think that we like to make the delineation between teaching and learning, and training and preparation, or training and skill. And again, these are things that I think should be synonymous. They shouldn't be separated. There should be one big pot of resources that allow people to do the all. They should have to pick and choose. So we have one of the states, or our system's first XR academies, where we have VR headsets in our library. So this is for everybody. We didn't build it to segregate. We built it to build commune and to pull people in. We did early preemptive ideology tests, where we included student athletes. faculty, staff, admin, senior executives, community members, elected officials, even the Secretary of State from Tennessee actually has been in a headset on our campus. And he was just like, this is unbelievable. It's amazing. So it's also tied into this concept of workforce development and student success for us, which is the mantras for our system. Can you imagine being any place that you want to be? And then, of course, people now recognize this through Facebook, now Meta's introduction to what they're doing with the Oculus and all these things. But literally, being any place on the planet and engaging either in skill development and or dialogue simultaneously with someone else anywhere on the planet. And again, as I mentioned in that English class, the visceral experience that takes place through learning is shared in a space that's collapsible, creative, and designed by students or corporations and companies to build a particular skill set or to create a certain type of indoctrination to a certain culture of this is how we answer the phone. You know, we try to answer the phone with a smile because people can hear you smiling on the other end. So gamification and XR, OER, and skill development, from our vantage point, they're all linked. We have faculty across all divisions at the college, whether it be STEM or humanities and art to business development, and even our folks who are thespians in speech and communication, they are using these platforms. Some have their own avatars, and it's a way for them to connect, relate, and share very, very important theoretical information in an applied fashion with our learners and our trainees. So it's been amazing.
That's amazing. And this is probably a perfect segue to what you just talked about. And also, as we start wrapping up the podcast, I always ask the presidents or the chancellors or any entrepreneurs on what do you see as a future of learning? And I think you already talked about with respect to Meta or use of technology with respect to game-based learning. But I think one of the missed opportunities in technology is if you look at the type of applications that's built, like for example, like Fortnite or Second Life or Sims, if you will. If you look at the type of games that the kids play are using, So if you look at the level of complexity involved in designing them and also the promotion scheme or going from level one to level two to level three and also asymmetrical nature of it, where you're not going from like math 100 to math 200, but you're going from a micro credential of one course and moving that step to the next level and the other parts of the course, as you expand your skill set, you go to the next level. So I always thought that, that is going to be the future of learning. But for that to happen, the big issue that I see is that there's nobody that's spending like millions of dollars building social sciences curriculum on a game app. Even though there's billions of dollars spent on building curriculums in education and billions of dollars spent on education software, there's nobody that's focused on merging those two together, saying this is the curriculum of whatever, physical sciences or social sciences, and this is the game platform. Let's build a full-on game curriculum for chemistry, math, or whatever. Do you see that happening anytime soon, or are we still in the initial stages of something like that?
I think we're still in the initial stages of it, and it's because of, I'll go back and tie it all together. The disparate nature of this is the pocket in which we operate in, and then there's a separate segregated group that operates in a different pocket, and it has nothing to do with language, has nothing to do with culture, has nothing to do with socioeconomic status, because technology is a leveling playing field. For all intents and purposes, most people do have smartphones or access to smart devices, whether they be tablets or there are some examples in India of a study done where a gentleman put a computer on a block, and ultimately those kids were learning and doing things that they taught themselves to do that graduate students were learning to do in a class. So for me, it is coming. It's a matter of that design thinking process. What groups of people will come together and determine that it's valuable to create a tool that is balanced for the development of the human being, both social consciousness, spirituality, if that should be a part of the tool, but being human, I think, is the most concrete way to put all of that. And then the converse of that is, what skills and acumen and interest level do young people have for the appetite of the market? And the appetite of the market really drives, and it ought to drive, what we teach and what we train young people on, so they are prepared to move smoothly into the marketplace or of employment. So putting those two things together, there is a sliver. I don't think it's a large gaping gap. I think that there are pieces of conversations that are intermixed and intermingled. It doesn't seem to be, we don't seem to have the appetite for it on a large scale yet, as you mentioned. But I do see that coming. And one of the things that I mentioned with the Metaversity project that we're working on is that it is tied to public good, social good, through super skills and Lego, and engagement globally with affiliates of an invite-only group through the World Bank, where we have conversations that are beyond your space, my space, our space, but period, it should be shared space. And so how do we collectively come to that common good of trusted learner networks via Arizona State University, creating space where we understand what personal sovereignty in the next iteration of Web3 will be, and what is it going to mean to be an issuer of credentials, an earner of credentials, or learners, whatever terms we're going to give to it. We get to design that, and I surely hope that we all are coming to it with that visage or that lens, that this is about all of us, not trying to reshape something in our image, but reshaping it so it's in the sensibilities of community.
That sounds great. Well, I certainly hope that will continue. And I agree with you, the public-private collaboration, whether it's with Meta or Google or AWS, is definitely the future of education. And the more we take education to the learner instead of bringing learner to the education like we've been doing, the more affordable education becomes and more accessible it becomes. Dr. Michael Torrence, it's been an incredible honor to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining the podcast.
Karen, thank you so much. It's been an honor, and I look forward to speaking with you again very soon.
Listeners, we'll post the show notes with links to Dr. Torrence's biography and also some additional links to see how he's innovating the campus. Thank you for tuning in.
Everything is a service. Whether it's finding ways to help students reach their goals within higher education, sharing medical records to patients quickly and securely, informing residential customers of an impending outage, or communicating with remote satellites thousands of miles apart. All of it requires data, integration, and communication. At End2End, we provide services that make all of these possibilities realities. And we make it faster, simpler, secure, and easier. Because we believe everything is a service, and bringing everything together is how we can help you innovate and change the world.